It is Wednesday, January 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Islamic State claims responsibility for an attack against an international aid group in Afghanistan. Congress resumes work on immigration following the recent government shutdown, and legendary South African jazz musician Hugh Masekela dies at the age of 78. It's all ahead. Gunmen stormed the offices of Save the Children in the eastern Afghan city of Jalalabad Wednesday, killing at least three people and wounding more than 20 others. A spokesman for the provincial government of Nangarhar says a group of armed men stormed the compound after a suicide bomber detonated a car bomb at the entrance. Security forces engaged in a long gun battle with the attackers before it ended. Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack. VOA's bureau chief for Pakistan and Afghanistan, Aisha Tanzim, describes to me what's known about the attack.
So what we know about this attack in Jalalabad is that, according to the security forces, there were three or four attackers. One of them exploded his vest near the entrance that made the way for the others to enter the compound. We've talked to eyewitnesses who saw a Toyota Corolla driving up to the entrance, and after the explosion, the first explosion, he saw three or four attackers entering the building. We were told that up to 12 wounded people were moved to the local hospitals. Another eyewitness reported seeing some dead bodies, but we do not have confirmation of that from the security forces. The Taliban have denied responsibility for this attack, but we have to remember that Jalalabad is the capital of Nangarhar province in eastern Afghanistan, which for the last 2 years, starting in January 2015, has been a stronghold and a hub for the Islamic State Khorasan province, which is Islamic State's local chapter in this region. But we also know that Nangarhar is the province which has been the deadliest for U.S. forces anywhere in the world last year, because the Afghan army is fighting them, the U.S. forces and NATO is fighting them in Nangarhar in several districts, not in Jalalabad, but in other districts. But we have seen the capacity of ISKP to carry out attacks in Kabul and Jalalabad in the past, so it's definitely not out of their reach.
Now, I believe that Save the Children has suspended its operations in Afghanistan.
So, yes, I can confirm that Save the Children has suspended its operation in Afghanistan. They announced it through their Twitter. And they basically said that they will resume operations in Afghanistan as soon as it's safe for them to do so. Meanwhile, they're trying to figure out exactly what happened and how it happened, and because, of course, it was primarily their office that was targeted.
This latest attack occurs just following the weekend attack in Kabul, where an international hotel was targeted. This certainly is very disturbing for any international aid or international operations in Afghanistan itself.
Afghanistan is one of the most difficult places in the world for any charity to operate, but definitely a Western charity to operate, because the Taliban have announced openly that they're going after Western targets. So, and also, even when these charities and the people who work for them are not facing direct attacks, they do face attempts to kidnap their personnel. So there are multiple kinds of threats that these charities face, which is why a lot of projects have been affected and millions of Afghans who need help are not getting the right kind of help because it's so difficult to operate there.
That is VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim, and she's reporting from Islamabad, Pakistan. Time now for social media. Pope Francis has denounced fake news as evil, and he's urged reporters to rediscover the dignity of journalism and search for the truth. In an annual message released Wednesday in advance of the Roman Catholic Church's World Communications Day on May 13th, the Pope wrote, "Spreading fake news can serve to advance specific goals, influence political decisions, and serve economic interests." The document was the first release by a pope on the topic and came after months of ongoing debate about the effect of fake news stories on the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The pope's message cited the difficulty people have of differentiating erroneous information from the truth due to their lack of exposure to information outlets that offer different opinions and perspectives. The pope wrote, "Disinformation thus thrives on the absence of healthy confrontation with other sources of information that could effectively challenge prejudices and generate constructive dialogue. Instead," he said, "it risks turning people into unwilling accomplices in spreading biased and baseless ideas." Pope Francis called on journalists to pursue information that is truthful and opposed to falsehoods, rhetorical slogans, and sensational headlines. And that's a look at social media. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The U.S. Special Counsel is looking to interview President Donald Trump in a probe of the Russian 2016 election meddling. UNICEF says Myanmar must guarantee the protection of Rohingya refugees. Pakistan condemns a unilateral U.S. drone strike. And a Brazilian appeals court will review the former president Lula da Silva's corruption conviction. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists at the University of New South Wales in Sydney say that they have found strong evidence that links a rare and mysterious polio-like illness called acute flaccid myelitis with a virus called enterovirus D68. The virus, known to cause symptoms of respiratory illness, was first identified in California in 1962. But in 2014, 9 pediatric patients were hospitalized at Children's Hospital Colorado with an unidentified illness that caused a polio-like paralysis. Since then, cases of the mystery disease appeared in other parts of the U.S., as well as Canada and Europe. The Centers for Disease Control says most of the patients in cases identified in 2014 described some improvement in their condition, while a small number of them reported either complete recovery or no improvement of function. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look back on the life of the late South African musician, Hugh Masekela. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence Tuesday said the timing of a new peace initiative for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict depends on the willingness of the Palestinians to return to the negotiating table. Speaking with Reuters, Pence said he hoped it might be made public this year, and the White House has been working with its Middle East partners to see if a framework for peace can be developed. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert was asked why rolling out the peace proposal is contingent on the Palestinians, which could mean it is never released.
Both parties have to be willing to work things out. It's like with any relationship, you both have to be willing to give. We've always said that this would be a difficult negotiation. It wouldn't be easy for either side, that both sides would have to be willing to commit to sit down and give a little and work out the situation. So I don't think it's for us to say, that one has to sit down. They have to be willing to do it themselves.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas denounced President Donald Trump's decision last month to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Pence said on Monday that the U.S. embassy will be moved to Jerusalem and will be opened at the end of next year. Mr. Abbas called the decision a slap in the face, adding the U.S. could no longer serve as a mediator in the peace process, which has remained moribund since 2013. He urged the European Union to recognize the Palestinian state. The Palestinians refused to meet with Pence during his Middle East trip. He met with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and Jordan's King Abdullah and urged them to tell the Palestinians the door is open and the U.S. wants to be part of the peace process. Russell Stone, professor emeritus at American University's Center for Israel Studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty little is known about the peace plan.
It seems to be a kind of a phantom peace plan. What Vice President Pence has dangled is, of course, the prospect of revealing it once the parties to the dispute say they're willing to enter in negotiations. So it's really a two-step process before we'll ever know what's in the peace plan.
Well, his comments suggest the Israelis are prepared, but the Palestinians must come back to the table.
That's the situation at the moment. If you follow the history of Middle East non-peace negotiations, it seesaws back and forth. When the Palestinians are ready to negotiate, Israel isn't. We're now in the opposite situation where the Israelis claim they're willing to negotiate, which they can comfortably because they know the Palestinian stance. They're by currying favor with the United States and knowing that there's no immediate prospect of resuming negotiation.
Pence said he and the president believe the decision to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem would improve peacemaking prospects.
Hard to understand how it would. The initial reactions to it have been anything but improving peace prospects. The most that could be said is that it wouldn't affect peace prospects one way or the other, but it certainly gives rise to protests both against the idea and against the American role in Middle East peace negotiation.
Well, after the unveiling of the announcement to move the embassy back in December, Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas called it a slap in the face and said the U.S. basically had abrogated its role as a mediator, as far as he's concerned, closes the door.
Yes, that's the situation at the moment. These things change, of course. He made himself scarce during Pence's visit. He left the area and traveled to Europe, so there would be no possibility of him meeting with Pence or with any of the visiting delegation.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up because he urged the European Union not just to back the two-state solution, which they did, but also to recognize the state of Palestine.
Yes, he's asking them to recognize the state of Palestine. He's also asking them to reinstate support for UNRWA, the refugee organization, which the United States has heavily supported in the past and is withdrawing some of their financial support.
Vice President Pence Tuesday also warned that President Trump's decision earlier this month to waive sanctions lifted following the 2015 Iranian nuclear deal will be the last time. He said the U.S. is sending a signal to its European allies the time has come for changes in the three-year nuclear agreement, including the sunset provisions that are eliminated. Otherwise, he said Washington is prepared to walk away from the deal. The U.S. government is back at work following a brief shutdown over the issue of immigration. A divided Congress will once again attempt to address the situation of the so-called Dreamers, young immigrants brought illegally into the U.S. by their parents. The issue motivates activists in both parties and could be a major factor in this year's midterm congressional elections. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
Thank you for hearing and answering our prayers.
With the Senate back in session, a prayer of thanks from Chaplain Barry Black after a brief government shutdown. Republicans believe they may have an advantage now in the negotiations over the status of the so-called Dreamers, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
This regrettable episode reminded all of us that in the United States Senate, brinksmanship and hostage-taking simply do not work.
President Trump proclaimed victory on Twitter and said he's ready to deal. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
He's going to play a big role in the process, but it's on Congress to get that legislation through the two bodies and hit the president's desk.
Trump may have strengthened his position, says analyst Zeke Miller.
So if the president is buoyed by this and he feels that this is a win for him, despite the embarrassment of, you know, sort of the show of dysfunction in Washington, but that he came out on top.
Democrats vowed to fight hard for the Dreamers on Tuesday, including Senate leader Chuck Schumer.
The Republican majority now has 16 days to work with us to write a bill that can get 60 votes and prevent the Dreamers from being deported. The clock is ticking. 16 days. That's not much time. We've got to get moving.
Schumer also withdrew an earlier offer to agree to a substantial down payment on Trump's border wall, a key campaign promise by the president. Polls show support for protecting the Dreamers, and their fate could factor into this year's congressional elections, where Democrats are focused on Trump as the defining issue, says John Fortier.
Democrats are united in one thing, that they don't like Donald Trump and that they want to run against him and the Republican Party. And so there's motivation on that side that unites their party just in that.
Yet Trump supporters are also likely to be motivated, says analyst Joy Reid.
The number one issue among these Trump voters was immigration. Far more than anything else, immigration was mentioned as a negative impact on the country.
The end of the government shutdown means crisis averted for now. But another showdown is looming just weeks away if Congress and the president can't agree on a way forward for the Dreamers. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Former USA Gymnastics team physician Larry Nassar faces sentencing Wednesday after pleading guilty to sexually abusing female gymnasts, some as young as 10 years old. A Michigan judge is expected to sentence Nassar to a lengthy prison term after pleading guilty in November to 10 counts of first-degree sexual assault. Prosecutors have requested a sentence of 40 to 125 years for Nassar, who was already serving a 60-year term on child pornography convictions. About 160 of Nassar's victims gave emotional statements at his sentencing hearing in a circuit court in Lansing, Michigan, since it began on January 16th. U.S. Olympic gold medalists Simone Biles, Gabby Douglas, and Michaela Maroney are among the athletes who have said in recent months they were assaulted by Nassar during medical treatment. Michigan Assistant Attorney General Angela Pavlaitis spoke before the sentencing.
The defendant is a twisted, beloved, renowned doctor who used his prestige to gain trust of these girls, to exploit them, leaving many of them emotionally shattered, used by a man that they not only trusted, but also loved.
The 54-year-old Nassar served as the USA gymnastics physician in four Olympic Games. Nassar was also the team physician for the Michigan State University's gymnastics and women's crew teams and an associate professor at the university's College of Osteopathic Medicine. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. South African jazz trumpeter and anti-apartheid activist Hugh Masekela died at the age of 78. Among his greatest hits were the anthem Bring Him Back Home, demanding Nelson Mandela's freedom from jail. But he recorded countless other solos and worked with other big names, including Senegalese and American superstars Youssou N'Dour and Paul Simon. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports on the outpouring of tributes to his long career in music and political activism.
Jazz legend Hugh Masekela uplifted the soul of an entire nation through his timeless music. South African officials said on Tuesday after the passing of a man they called a one-of-a-kind musician. He's known for many hits, including Bring Back Nelson Mandela, a tribute to the former South African president.
But on my birthday in 1985, Nelson Mandela sent me a birthday card, letter actually, that was smuggled out of Portsmouth prison, and in it, he just like encouraged us, you know, with the music school and with them and the recordings, and he knew everything. He knew my children's names, he knew my wife's name. Well, he's gone to school with my wife's father at University of Fort Hare. And he just wished me luck with all these things. But it was just a letter, and I was blown away. I went to the piano, and I started singing Bring Back Nelson Mandela.
Many today are fondly remembering the legendary musician who they affectionately referred to as Bra Hugh.
He wasn't a musician who was too aware of his own greatness. You know, he was always open to sharing and to teaching. That was, for me, one of his greatest gifts, you know, his ability to share what he knew, and his long, legendary achievements never got in the way of him looking at somebody who's starting out and saying, what are you doing? How can I help?
President Jacob Zuma praised the legendary trumpeter, cultural activist, and liberation struggle veteran as the one who kept the torch of freedom alive, globally fighting apartheid through his music. His family says he passed peacefully in Johannesburg after a courageous battle with prostate cancer. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Donald Trump recently welcomed Kazakh President Nursultan Nazarbayev to the White House, where he noted that Kazakhstan has made great strides since gaining independence in 1991. In the years since Kazakhstan's independence, the United States and Kazakhstan worked together to rid Kazakhstan of nuclear weapons and secure dangerous radiological materials. Kazakhstan continues to be a valued partner in nuclear nonproliferation. Presidents Trump and Nazarbayev discussed efforts to achieve a Korean peninsula free of nuclear weapons. Together, said President Trump, we are determined to prevent the North Korean regime from threatening the world with nuclear devastation. President Trump also thanked President Nazarbayev for his assurances that Kazakhstan will continue to provide critical access for supplies and equipment used by U.S. troops fighting ISIS and the Taliban in Afghanistan. The U.S. particularly appreciates Kazakhstan's work to train and educate Afghan civilian specialists and Kazakhstan's pledge of additional support to bolster Afghan security. American businesses are currently among the largest investors in Kazakhstan, particularly in the energy sector. The U.S. supports Kazakhstan's efforts to become a top 30 global economy by 2050. That includes working to improve Kazakhstan's business environment, which will create new opportunities for American companies operating there and provide additional jobs in both countries. President Trump stressed the importance of fair and reciprocal trade for both countries. The United States values Kazakhstan's participation in the Central Asia Trade Forum and in the Central Asia Trade and Investment Framework Agreement. Both countries are working together to bring U.S. products and services to the Kazakhstani people across a range of industries, including commercial aircraft, railways, medical services, technology, and energy. Working in common cause, we can advance greater opportunity for citizens in both of our countries, said President Trump. We want a strong, sovereign, and thriving future for Kazakhstan and for the peace-loving nations of the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
To bebop, to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond.
Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at VOA News.